City of New York. Franny shielded her eyes from the thin sunlight to watch the crow perch on the angel's hand. Below him, sitting on the rim of the fountain, was a man in a black suit paging through the scarlet letter, which had been forgotten and left behind. He wore a white shirt and a black tie and shoes so old it was evident that he favored simple things. When he came to the title page and saw the dedication, he didn't need to read any further. He closed the book. After his father's discovery, Levi was no longer allowed to leave the house unless he was going directly to work or to school. The telephone was cut off, so it was impossible to reach him. Their copy of the scarlet letter was mailed back to Jet without a note, and the handwriting on the envelope clearly wasn't Levi's. Packed with the book were half a dozen nails. "What on earth is this supposed to mean?" Jet said anxiously. "It means his father is deranged," Franny said. She quickly gathered the nails and threw them into the trash. She knew from her readings at the library that witch hunters believed a witch could be caught by nailing her steps to the ground to ensure that she couldn't run. A witch's powers were decreased when she was near metal. Surround her with it and she would be helpless. Luckily, Franny had also grabbed the scarlet letter. When it fell open in her hands, she saw that someone had scrawled over Jet's lovely inscription with thick black ink and written their own message. "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." Franny recognized the quote from Exodus, for it had been scrawled in the judge's notes at Maria's trial. It was the same quote that had been on the title page of The Discovery of Witches, written by Matthew Hopkins, the witch-finder general of England in 1647, the man who was believed to be responsible for the deaths of 300 women. "I think April's right," Franny told her sister that night when they were both in bed. Jet had been crying for hours, but Franny's comment stunned her. Franny had never thought April to be right about anything. She sat up in bed.
"You do?"
"You should stay away from Levi." Jet fell back into her pillow.
"Oh, Franny."
"Did you hear me?" Franny asked.
"Yes,"
Jet said, no longer in tears and more determined than Franny might have imagined.
"I heard you, and I wish I hadn't."
She went to Vincent for help. A rebel could only depend on another rebel. She trailed him to the Jester, getting on the Fifth Avenue bus, then walking half a block behind him. She was amused that he didn't have a clue that he was being followed until she slid into the booth beside him. She had thrown up an invisibility shield that had clearly worked. "Good God, Jet," he said. "What do you think you're doing? This is not your kind of place." All the same, he called for two beers. If his sister was going to be here, she might as well drink. Jet placed a letter on the table. "Let me guess, for Levi?"
"Just this once," Jet said.
"Yeah, I think that's what you always say. How do you propose I get it to him?" Jet took a bus ticket from her purse. "Massachusetts," Vincent nodded. "You seem to have it all covered." He was actually impressed. "And what do I tell the parents?" Jet had a copy of the school newspaper. The Starling Band had been invited to play at a prep school north of Boston. "I've joined the band," Vincent said.
"Yesterday," Jet told him.
"I'm very clever," Vincent said. "Aren't I?"
"The music teacher said he'd been trying to get you to join for ages. He's delighted."
"Do I actually have to play?"
"There's a concert in the morning. Then you take a taxi and wait for Levi outside of his school at 3.
"And if his father's there waiting, too, have you factored in that possibility?" Jet took a sip of the beer Vincent had ordered.
"Then you use the Magus."
He recognized Levi right away. The white shirt, the dark hair, his serious demeanor as he made his way down the steps of the high school. He went right past Vincent in a hurry. Vincent rose to his feet and took off running to catch up with him. "Hey, Levi, slow down." Levi threw him a puzzled look.
I don't know you.
Yeah, well, I know you. Slow the fuck down.
I have to get to work.
Levi had slowed his pace.
Over at the pharmacy.
He looked at Vincent more closely.
Did you want something?
No, but you do. Vincent took out the letter. From my sister. Levi grabbed the letter and tore it open, reading it hungrily. Vincent gazed around.
Your father's not here, is he?
What? No. Levi went on reading.
You're supposed to give me $20.
I am?
Sorry, I wouldn't ordinarily agree to this, but my father puts all of my earnings into a bank account I can't access. I need money for the bus to New York.
Vincent gave him the 20.
You don't think you might be looking for trouble?
Levi thanked Vincent for the loan, but laughed at the question.
Life is trouble, brother. You've got to fight for what you want.
They shook hands.
Vincent didn't know what to think.
He saw in Levi something he'd never felt himself. This was what love looked like. This was what it could do to you. Vincent found himself walking to Magnolia Street. It had begun to rain, and so he ran. He wondered if he would ever feel that someone was worth fighting for. If there would ever be a person who would make him stand up and take a chance and have the courage to be reckless.
Isabel wasn't surprised to see him. When she gave him tea and a piece of pie, he realized he was starving.
He explained that he had been in the school band, but had quit once their performance was over.
I take it you're not staying?
Isabel had noticed he had nothing with him but a jacket.
The school reserved hotel rooms. I only came to deliver a letter for Jet.
It was impossible to tell a lie to their aunt.
Levi Willard, Isabel said. I used to see them walking together last summer.
Apparently his father hates us.
Did he see you?
I don't think so. Isabel gestured for Vincent to lift up his left foot. She took his heavy black boot in her hand and examined the sole. There was a nail through it.
Think again, Isabel said. He knew you were here. He left out nails.
Vincent fiddled with the nail, his face furrowed.
I can't get it out.
Of course not. This is the sort witch hunters use.
Isabel took a small vial from a shelf, rosemary oil infused with holly and hyssop. She dabbed some on the nail and uttered an oath.
This cannot harm you on this day. When you walk away. When you return, all of your enemies will burn.
What happened between our families? Vincent asked.
Family,
Isabel corrected. Now he was thoroughly confused.
What do you mean?
I mean what I say.
We're related?
Charlie is here,
Isabel said. A battered station wagon had pulled up at the gate. None of the local taxi services would come to Magnolia Street. Therefore, Isabel had called Charlie Merrill, the handyman, to give Vincent a ride back to the hotel where the band was staying.
Is there more to the story? Vincent asked.
There's more to every story,
his aunt told him. On the drive, Charlie was pleasant enough, though he barely spoke. He was even older than Aunt Isabel and had lived in town all his life.
Do you know the Willards? Vincent asked him.
The Willards?
Yeah, the Reverend and his son.
Did your aunt say I knew them?
She didn't say anything.
Well then,
I don't know anything.
Clearly the handyman's loyalty was to Isabel. He didn't utter another word other than good night when they got to the hotel. Vincent was glad to have a room to himself.
Something didn't feel right.
He felt a chill. He wondered if what people said was true, that no one could hate you more than members of your own family. He felt an ache, so he propped his foot up on his right knee. The nail was gone. But when he took off his boots and socks, he noticed there was a hole in his left foot. It was a good thing he had gone to his aunt for help. The nail had already drawn blood.
It began to snow toward the end of December, big flakes that stuck to the pavement. Soon the drifts were knee-high, and the streets were difficult to navigate. It was the week before Christmas, and the stores were busy with shoppers. Franny was looking for a microscope at a lab warehouse. It would be an ideal gift for Halen. She had dragged her brother and sister along.
"I thought you didn't believe in presents," Vincent said.
"This is different," Franny said. "It's practical." Vincent and Jet exchanged a look. Their sister without a heart had spent 2 hours looking for the perfect microscope. On the way to the warehouse, they'd stopped at a coffee shop, and when Franny ordered toast, the pats of butter melted as soon as she reached for them. When at last she was done shopping and the gift had been chosen and boxed, all three wheeled into the street where the snow was still swirling down, faster now, like a snow globe, with drifts so high many parked cars were buried. It was already twilight and the world had turned an inky blue. They walked arm in arm, mesmerized by the beauty of the blue-white flakes all around them. Anything seemed possible. Even to Vincent, who turned out the streetlights as they walked on.
"Let's always remember how beautiful tonight is," Jet said.
"Of course we will," Franny agreed. But Vincent would be the one to remember this evening when his sisters had long forgotten how they'd tried and failed to get a cab, then took the subway singing "This Land Is Your Land," and how the microscope was so heavy they'd had to take turns carrying it. When they got home, Vincent went to his room and closed the door. He sat on his messy, unmade bed. His clairvoyance was becoming more intense. He experienced the future not as a panoramic vista, but as bits and pieces, like a living, crazy quilt. It was becoming more difficult for him to deny what he saw. A man standing on a hillside in California in a field of yellow grass. A street in Paris. A girl with gray eyes. A cemetery filled with angels. A door he'd have to open in order to walk through. One spring day, they knew something out of the ordinary had transpired, because their mother had ordered a huge cake, which was set out on the dining room table. She had lit 100 candles, which shivered with yellow light even though it was no one's birthday. 50 candles would have been more than enough. Even more revealing that something was up, their father was putting in an appearance at the dinner table. And what's more, he had actually cooked, fixing Ritz crackers with brie and red peppers warmed up in a Pyrex dish. Before a family meeting could commence, Vincent was called out of his room. He came into the dining room brooding, annoyed to be called away from the world of his bedroom, which reeked of smoke and magic. He had found a hanging wicker chair with a lattice seat, which he had attached to the ceiling with bolts. He often perched there, bat-like, practicing guitar riffs for hours, in no mood to be disturbed. Once they had all gathered, their parents let loose and roared with pride.
"Congratulations!" James Burke Owens waved an envelope. "This just arrived from a little college on the banks of the River Charles."
Anyone crossing paths with the doctor would know he went to Harvard and then Yale within 5 minutes of meeting him. He now clasped Franny to him in a bear hug.
"You're a good girl, Frances Owens."
Franny, always embarrassed by displays of emotion, slipped out of her father's embrace. She took the envelope from him, barely able to contain her excitement. Inside was her acceptance to Radcliffe, Harvard's all-female equivalent, created when higher education for women was scandalous.
"You've joined the club," her father boasted.
"We all knew you were the smart one," Vincent said. "Now don't screw it up."
"Very funny," Franny responded.
She knew Vincent to be the most intelligent among them all, albeit the laziest. The admission to Radcliffe was not in the least bit funny to Jet. College catalogs had been arriving in the mail for some time, and Jet had worried that when Franny went off to Cambridge or New Haven, she would be forced to deal with her parents on her own. How would she ever be able to see Levi without Franny to cover for her? She simply could not live without him. That very afternoon, they had sat on a park bench kissing until they were dizzy. When it came time to part, they were upset, and they continued to embrace in the Port Authority bus terminal while Levi missed one bus after another. Now, as the family was celebrating Franny's acceptance to Radcliffe, Jet did something terrible. She wished that Franny wouldn't be able to leave New York. She knew she was being selfish, and she chastised herself for it afterward. But it was too late. The wish had been made. It was bitter and carried the acrid scent of smoke. And when it lodged somewhere inside Jet, it made her cough, a hacking rattle that lasted for months.
"Cheer up," Vincent said as Jet despondently watched their parents open a bottle of champagne. "It won't be as bad as you think."
"What won't be?"
Vincent tousled her black hair. "Your future." It was then she realized that Franny could provide the perfect excuse to see Levi. Every time she said she was going to visit Franny in Cambridge, she could get off the train at New Haven. Levi had gotten into Yale, and he would be there waiting for her. She thought she would bring him a new coat on her very first visit. Then he wouldn't have to keep the old one his father had him wear. She had changed her mind about Franny going off to school. She even drank some champagne. She took back her wish right then and there, but unfortunately, such things simply can't be done. Halen's letter from Harvard arrived in the mail the following day. He came around to collect Franny so they could celebrate their impending independence from their small-minded parents and their dreadful school and awful childhoods, for which they were already feeling nostalgic. They nestled close together to avoid a pale rain as they walked toward Madison Avenue, pretending to fight over a single umbrella. "The only thing I'm taking with me when I leave is the microscope," Halen announced. "I'm donating everything else." At the coffee shop on the corner, they ordered waffles and eggs, and because all of Manhattan smelled like bacon that day, a side of Canadian bacon as well. Hay topped it off by wolfing down 2 jelly donuts, which he'd craved ever since his marijuana experiments. They were both starving for food and for freedom. The brilliance of the day made them dizzy and hopeful in ways they had never imagined. In Cambridge, anything could happen. The rain was stopping. The air was green. Spring was thick with lilacs and possibility. Everything was delicious. Their food and New York City and their futures. Hay was to live in Dunster House, Franny a stone's throw away if you had a strong arm, which Halen did, at South House on the Radcliffe Quad. They toasted to liberty, clinking together their glasses of orange juice. "Oh, joy," they crooned to one another. "Oh, learning and books and baked beans and the Red Sox and the filthy Charles River." They had all spring and summer to enjoy Manhattan. The magnolias and ornamental cherry trees were blooming in the park. They met at twilight, free spirits, no longer tethered to their parents' wishes. They explored every acre of the park they so loved and would sorely miss, watching constellations from Sheep Meadow, wading in the chilly loch, studying the white-footed mice that collected acorns along Cedar Hill, tracking the red bats nesting in the English oaks and black locusts. Lewis the Crow followed them, and Halen fed Franny's familiar bits of crusts when they brought along sandwiches.
"You'll spoil him," Franny said. "He's supposed to be wild."
"Maybe he'd rather be tame," Halen responded thoughtfully. Hay had already confided that if he were ever to inherit his family's money, he would dispose of it, for every time he walked into their limestone mansion on Fifth Avenue, he felt he had made a wrong turn, and had mistakenly come to live with a family who would have been much happier with a different son.
"You're the only person who really knows me," he told Franny. She kissed him then. She didn't plan it. She simply felt a wave of emotion she couldn't name. It was impossible for anything to happen between them. Still, she kissed him again, and then once more for luck. Vincent was at the Jester, where he had become a regular, and he was drunk. He hadn't told his sisters how much of the future he could see, because he didn't like it one bit. Luckily, Franny, rather than one of their parents, picked up the phone when the bartender called to say the wizard might need help getting home.
"Who on earth is that?" Franny said.
"The kid who does magic tricks. He gave me your number. He said he was your brother."
When she said that he was indeed, Franny was informed that Vincent could usually be talked into performing tricks after he'd had a few. The lights would flicker, matches would flame with a puff of breath, silverware would rattle as though there was an earthquake. Now, however, he was plastered and likely a danger to himself. Franny took a cab, then made her way into the dimly lit bar. The bartender waved her over.
"He's been drinking since noon," he said.
Franny asked for a glass of tomato juice, extra large, then proceeded to a booth where Vincent was resting his head on the red plastic padding behind him.
"Hey there, sister," he said, when Franny flung herself into the seat across from him.
She'd brought a cure for drunkenness, a powder composed of cayenne, caffeine, and St. John's wort, which she now dispensed into the tomato juice.
"Drink,"
she said. Vincent sipped, then shuddered in disgust.
"You're better than this," Franny said.
"Am I?" "I see things I can't change, Franny. When I drink, I stop the visions. It was in pieces, but it's coming together in one picture. And lately, what I've been seeing is an accident. A bad one. And soon."
"If you keep drinking like this, I'm sure there will be one sooner or later."
Franny sounded flip, but all the same, she felt a chill. Vincent's eyes were nearly black. Never a good sign.
"I'm serious," he said. "Our family. This month, when there's a full moon."
"Well, then you don't have to worry."
There had been a full moon at the beginning of the month. "It's come and gone." Franny remembered the moon because she and Hay had sneaked out to meet at 74th Street in front of the statue of Alice in Wonderland. Midnight had been bright as day, and they could easily read the lines chiseled in granite around the sculpture. "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe." Franny had started something between them with a kiss, and now what was done could not be undone, nor would she want it to be. Brillig was said to mean 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but surely it must mean more. Broiling, brilliant, luminous, shimmering, unstoppable.
"Stop worrying about the moon," she told Vincent, "and start worrying about your drinking."
She gestured to the glass before him, and Vincent gulped down the rest of the drunkenness cure. He already seemed more clear-headed, but when he set the glass down, it shattered into thin shards and turned blue.
"You're paying for that, wizard," the bartender called.
Vincent looked into Franny's disapproving eyes. He seemed shocked and concerned. "I swear I did not do that." A glass breaking on its own portended death.
"I'm telling you the truth," Vincent said. "Death is close by. I've never felt anything like this. I can almost touch it. It's like a black circle coming closer and closer."
He reached his hand into the air, and when he opened his closed fist, soot appeared in his palm.
"Ashes," he said. "Franny, you have to listen to me."
Franny felt a scrim of fear. Still, she approached his prediction logically.
"Certainly, somewhere, someone will die. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with us."
She grabbed her brother's arm and shook it so that the ashes lifted into the air, where they turned white and scattered into the corners of the room. Then she used a napkin to gather the slivers of glass and brought the mess up to the bar.
"He's underage," she told the bartender. "Don't serve him again."
They walked home together deep in thought. They didn't hear the bees until they reached the corner. As they neared their house, they could see swarms at every window. They stopped where they were. Bees tried to get into a house when a death was imminent. I'll have Mother call an exterminator, Franny said.
Vincent was suddenly stone-cold sober. It won't make a difference. We can't stop it.
Of course we can. You can change your fate.
Can you? They stepped closer to each other.
Do you know who's in danger? Franny asked.
I can't tell. I don't think it's us, because we're seeing the omen.
They stood there, shoulders touching. Bees don't swarm at night. Glass doesn't break without a cause. Ashes do not fall from above. All the same, Franny still didn't quite believe Vincent until they entered the front hallway. There on the threshold was a beetle.
Fuck, Vincent said. He went to stomp on the creature. He knew what it was from his readings in the Magus, and he now advised Franny that Death Watch beetles are wood borers that can be heard in the rafters calling for mates. They signified a death.
You cannot destroy destruction, the Magus warned, though you may try.
Vincent had gotten rid of the beetle, but not its message.
You cannot unwrite a death that has been written.
There was no spell strong enough to do so. Franny went for a broom and a dustpan to dispose of the remnants of the beetle. Jet was in the kitchen.
What's that? She said when the creature was tossed in the trash. Something to avoid. From now on, no taking chances, no talking to strangers, no walking through the park at night.
I thought we were supposed to have courage.
Just for now. Don't do anything out of the ordinary.
It was decided that Franny would be the one to wait up and tell the parents. They had debated, and when it came down to it, they felt that the parents had to be told for their own protection. They'd been to a party at the new Guggenheim Museum and were tipsy upon their return. "Amazing evening," her father remarked. "That building is the future."
"Speaking of the future," Franny said, "I have information about our family I'd like to discuss with you."
"You handle this," Dr. Burke Owen said to his wife. "It's your family."
Once he'd left the room, Franny turned to her mother. "There was an omen, and we need to pay heed."
"Franny," their mother was exasperated,
"let's not have any nonsense tonight. I don't think I can take this any more than your father can. I know you don't want to believe in any of this, but there were bees swarming the house." "Fine, I'll call an exterminator in the morning." "And a beetle in the hall."
That stopped Susanna.
"What sort of beetle?"
"The bad sort," Franny said. "A Death Watch beetle."
Susanna reconsidered. There was no reason to be impulsive when all signs pointed to caution.
"I don't see the harm in doing as you say. No chances will be taken. Now convince your sister of that, since she's been so foolish lately."
"She's already agreed," Franny said.
"Fine. We will all be cautious."
Yet Franny continued to have a nest of nerves in the pit of her stomach. She went to the bedroom and perched on the edge of Jet's bed. She felt a rush of love for her sleeping sister, the most kind-hearted person she had ever known. Rather than going to sleep herself, Franny crept out the open window. Louis was there, waiting for her. She'd swiped a dinner roll, which she now broke into three pieces, signaling to each crust. She called each crust by name.
"Mother, father, sister."
"Which one?" she asked.
But Louis flew off, disappearing into the pitch-black sky.
"You're supposed to do as I say,"
Franny called after him, distraught, wounded by his refusal to predict the future. Her familiar had made it clear that a crow may be a confidant and a companion, even a spy, but never a servant. In this regard, he mirrored his mistress's flinty independence. If he cried, as she now did, surely no one would ever know. On Jet's birthday, the parents surprised her with tickets to a Broadway musical and a special dinner at the Russian Tea Room. She was turning 17, and was as near to perfect as she'd ever be.
Ever since the winter, Jet had collected canned food for the local soup kitchen, and she often worked there on holidays, peeling potatoes and slicing carrots. People said she resembled a young Elizabeth Taylor, whose photograph had graced the cover of Life magazine earlier in the year, when Miss Taylor won the Oscar for Best Actress in Butterfield 8. Jet was an A student at Starling and had never caused her parents a single bit of worry until this Levi Willard business. But the parents were relieved that folly seemed to be old news now. Jet seemed to have turned a corner on that score. Not that they would allow her to go to Magnolia Street this summer, even though her time to visit Aunt Isabel had come. That would be tempting fate.
"You're still the favorite," Franny remarked with zero jealousy.
She was sprawled across her bed watching Jet choose her dress for the evening.
"I am not," Jet insisted.
"Has our mother ever slapped you?" All the same, Jet was pleased with the fuss being made over her. Her birthday was indeed a special occasion, although no one in the family knew quite how special it would be. Franny had bought her a silver bangle bracelet in the jewelry department at Macy's. Vincent presented her with a record album by a folk singer named Pete Seeger, whose songs were so filled with humanity they brought Jet to tears. But best of all, Levi would be waiting for her at the Bethesda Fountain later tonight. He'd sold a watch that had belonged to his great-great-grandfather so he could rent them a room at the Plaza Hotel. Jet was nervous but ecstatic. All she had to do was sneak away after the theater, and she'd be free. It would be worth the trouble she'd be in when she returned in the morning. She had tried on nearly all of her dresses when Franny suggested she wear the black mini dress April had sent as a present from a shop on Newbury Street in Boston. Even Franny had to admit April had style.
"It's your birthday," Franny told her sister.
"Live a little." Vincent straggled in and threw himself onto Jet's bed, which by now was piled with discarded clothing. "Live a lot," he advised. Jet was persuaded to add a floppy hat, then Franny dabbed on some lip gloss and mascara, and there Jet was, utterly gorgeous. Franny was a little in awe of her younger sister's shimmering beauty.
"If those bitches at Starling could see you now, they'd hate you even more. Just be careful tonight."
Once the parents had left with Jet, Vincent grabbed his leather jacket and nodded to Franny. "Let's get out of this mausoleum."
"The sooner the better," Franny agreed.
Halen was probably already at their usual meeting place.
Franny latched the front door, and they set out into the lovely summer evening.
A limo sped by with a whoosh of air, and Franny felt a chill, which she ignored. Surely there was nothing to worry about on this perfect night. When they reached the corner of 89th and 5th, brother and sister went their separate ways. "Use caution," Franny called to her brother, who waved to her before he headed downtown. Franny then went directly to the 90th Street entrance, eager to step into the cool, silent park. Lately, she was disturbed by her strong feelings toward Halen. She just couldn't seem to control them, though she tried her best. Every time they were together, she held back. They would be all over each other, and then she would pull away to stalk off by herself, not wanting him to see how she was burning for him.
"Not again," Halen would say, twisted with desire. "Geez, Franny, I'm dying here."
Franny had vowed she would not go anywhere near love, but here she was standing on the very edge of it, about to fall. She wasn't certain how long this denial could go on, or if she even wanted it to. Tonight she wore her usual outfit of a black shirt, black slacks, and a pair of sneakers. It didn't matter what she wore or how she might try to downplay her looks. Franny possessed a rare beauty. With her long red hair and pale, flawless skin, she resembled a woodland creature as she ducked under thickets.
"Caution above all else," she told herself. But there he was, waiting for her on the path. And Franny had never been an admirer of caution.
They headed for the Ramble. It was a glorious evening. They stopped once to kiss and could go no farther, until Franny broke away, fevered, far too attracted to him. As they came to the model boat pond, formerly called Conservatory Water, Hay reached for some change so he could buy lemonade from the kiosk.
"Hey, look at this," he said.
All of the quarters in his hand were tarnished. He had no idea that the silver in a man's pockets always turns black if he kisses a witch. There were inky clouds in the even darker sky, and the horizon was painted with a blue-black tint. What was pale glowed brilliantly through the dark. Franny's freckled skin, some renegade white nightshade growing nearby, the moon bright and full. It was a blue moon, the name for the second full moon in a single month, the 13th full moon of the year. If Franny had remembered Vincent's remark about the danger of the moon, she might have heard the clamor of a warning bell. Instead, she and Hay went to Belvedere Lake, which they called Turtle Pond due to the dozens of pet turtles released there. It was set just below the imposing Belvedere Castle. The castle was made of gray granite, a bronze-winged dragon in the transom. Halen grinned and said, "We could live there and no one would know." It was the grin that always tugged at something inside Franny. He seemed so pure. Wrong and right were fixed points in Halen's mind. When he spoke about the many inequities facing those people who had no say in their own futures, Franny felt the sting of tender admiration stirring inside her. Still, she did not wish to have a heart, for such a thing could be broken. She thought of the women who knocked on the back door at Magnolia Street, desperate for love, crying at the kitchen table, each willing to pay any price to win the attention of some man who didn't know she was alive. Franny had been convinced it was only a rumor that Aunt Isabel was given all manner of jewelry as payment, until she saw a neighbor take off her cameo necklace and leave it on the kitchen table. And then one day, as she was searching a cabinet for the salt shaker, she found a plastic container that rattled. Inside were a dozen diamond rings. She thought Jet was a fool to look for love, but here she was with Halen trying to make sense of her frantic heart. Sooner or later she would figure out the curse. Mysteries could be solved if one applied logic and patience. As they sat on a flat rock, with the evening floating down around them, Franny and Hay traded tales they'd heard about the pond, urban legends about snapping turtles so huge they would leap into the air to catch pigeons that were then drowned and devoured, and of pet fish released from their small bowls that had grown enormous, with sharp teeth and wicked dispositions. There was a lady rumored to live in the shrubbery who was said to catch turtles for her supper. She could be spied begging for spare change on the corner near the Starling School.
"Don't think this won't happen to you," she hissed at all the pretty young girls passing by. "Youth is fleeting. It's nothing but a dream. I'm where you're going. I'm what you'll be."
They called her the Pond Lady and ran from her shrieking, but they couldn't get her warning out of their minds. Caution, these girls thought. As for Franny, she always gave the Pond Lady a dollar when she saw her, for she had no fear of who she would turn out to be. When the theater let out, Jet was walking on air. She quickly worked a believe-me spell before telling her parents that the girls from Starling were having a slumber party in honor of her birthday. Wasn't that what they had wanted? For her to be popular and accepted? "Address, please," her father said. 92nd and 3rd, Jet responded, having already practiced the answers to most of the possible questions she might be asked.
"Let us drop you," Susanna said, hailing a cab. "Oh, Mother, they'll think I'm a baby."
Jet kissed her parents goodbye. Then she slipped into the taxi and leaned forward to ask the driver to take her to 59th Street. Off they went, for there was a plan. One that had nothing to do with the girls at school, who couldn't have cared less that it was Jet Owens's birthday. But someone cared desperately, and had already been waiting for her for over an hour at the entrance to the park on Central Park South. They would spend the night together at the Plaza Hotel, the grandest, most romantic hotel in New York, built in 1907,
designed as if it were a French chateau. In the park across the street from the hotel, there was the elegant golden equestrian statue of General Sherman and his horse by the sculptor Augustus Saint-Gaudens. In addition to selling his great-great-grandfather's watch, Levi had been saving for this special night, working overtime at the pharmacy, delivering newspapers in the early mornings. Spying Levi from the cab was the best moment of Jet's life. She was ready to fall in love without looking back. Frankly, she had already fallen. She paid, then ran out to embrace Levi. They kissed and barely noticed the world around them. Horns honked, and they were nearly run over by a bicyclist. Levi laughed and pulled Jet out of harm's way. He was carrying her birthday present, an old edition of Emily Dickinson's poems. If I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain. As Jet was about to open the book, as her heart was lifting and her life just beginning, her parents' taxi roared up. They'd heard her tell the cabbie the address of the plaza, and suspicious, they had followed, up 6th Avenue, turning onto 59th Street. Susanna opened the window now and called shrilly, using Jet's rarely used given name. "Bridget Owens, you stop right there." Jet looked up at her mother and panicked. The cab was racing toward them. Before her parents could leap out and drag her away, before they could ruin her life, she took hold of Levi's arm and cried out, "Let's run." He didn't even know what they were running from, but he knew he was dedicated to protecting Jet. They headed for the park, and as they did, the parents' cab driver was told to step on it and not let them escape. There was an oil slick on the road, beneath the pools of spilled water used for the horses pulling the carriages that took tourists and lovers through the park. It was dark, and the city smelled like freshly spaded earth. Just across from the Plaza Hotel, the taxi skidded out of control. Birds in the trees took flight and filled the ember sky. Levi leapt in front of Jet as the taxi came barreling onto the sidewalk. Time slowed so that she could see his eyes dilate when he realized what was happening. It was so very slow, they might have been caught in a glass jar. She could hear his thoughts. "Not yet. Not this." And then time sped up. It rolled up right under their feet and caught them off balance. The air was alive and pushed against Jet like a wave. But it was Levi who was pushing her out of the way. She lay on the cold ground as glass shattered and fell over her like a hard rain. There was no other sound, no birds, no traffic, nothing but the sound of her heart thudding against her chest. There was nothing else beyond this moment when she heard the taxi hit Levi, the sound of the world cracking in two. And then she heard his voice. And he said only one word, and that last word was her name. At Turtle Pond, Franny had slipped off her sneakers and was letting her pale feet dangle over the edge of the rocks. The night was perfect, and she worried about perfect things, for there were often flaws seen only under a microscope with a very clear eye. She felt a chill go through her, as if the wind had blown directly through her chest. All at once there were tears in her eyes. "I'll swim here if you will," Halen announced, already stripping off his shirt. He always wanted to prove himself to Franny, yet he never exuded the same confidence. Hay had recognized that she had a strange sort of courage. She didn't even seem to notice when she was in danger. Perhaps that was why he was driven by the need to be brave and why he stood on the very edge of the rock, his heart thudding, his emotions at a fever pitch. If courage was what she wanted, that was what he'd give her. "Seriously," he said, "let's swim." Franny shook her head no. She felt nerves again, right in the pit of her stomach, as if the world was about to spin out of control. Another time she might have been thrilled by Halen's proposed leap into the muddy abyss. But she knew the warning. She must use caution. Plus, swimming with him was out of the question. She would only float, and he would wonder why, and there was no way for her to explain the reason.
The water was murky, filled with mysterious, mossy items. Still, Halen didn't back down. He pulled off his boots and unzipped his jeans, then took everything off. She'd never seen him naked. He was like a statue. Perfect. Halen inhaled, then leapt into the pond. The turtle splashed away as he disappeared into the blackness of the surface. Water rose up and slapped against the rocks, then spilled onto the path. Though the pond was filled from a tap, trash left to sink to its depths made the water appear ominous and unclean, likely chock full of strange debris and unknown pathogens. Franny's heart was hitting against her chest. Halen would probably need a tetanus shot. He didn't rise. Franny thought of bees and ashes and broken glass. But Halen hadn't been inside their house when the Death Watch beetle appeared, so surely he'd be safe. And yet there was a circle forming around the spot where he had disappeared. No air bubbles. No Halen. Franny wanted to leap in after him, but she knew from the time spent in Leech Lake it was impossible. She would only float to the surface. Because she couldn't be drowned, she couldn't follow him into the depths to save him. She was frantic, her pulse pounding, fearing that the curse was happening right now. When Hay suddenly reappeared, he broke the surface like some sort of enormous fish. He was sputtering for air, turning blue. He struggled for breath, then met her eyes. Franny sat frozen on the rock. A kind of terror had immobilized her. Caution. Hay shook his head. "Jesus, Franny," he said. She'd never seen anyone look as sad or disappointed. He swam to the rocks with two strokes of his long arms and hoisted himself out. His hair was slicked back. His penis looked blue from the cold. Franny had a small shiver of what she thought was fear, but it was really something else entirely, what she didn't want to feel for him and already did. Hay reached for his clothes and pulled them on even though he was soaking wet. "There's a shopping cart down there. My leg got stuck. I almost couldn't surface. In case you care."
"Halen," Franny spoke with emotion. "Of course I do."
"There's something wrong between us, Franny." Hay cast his large wet feet into his boots without bothering with socks. Then he came to her and put his hands on her shoulders. He was shaking from the frigid water and from raw emotion. "Were you going to let me drown? Seriously, tell me the truth. You're keeping something from me. What are we to each other, Franny?" Before she could answer everything and explain the curse of who she really was, Franny spied a figure weaving through the trees. He was headed straight toward them with a strange, shuddering gait. It was Vincent, and he was barefoot. He'd run all the way down 89th Street and through the park and was now sprinting forward, crying out her name. Franny pulled away from Halen. She could hear bees, the ones that had been there on the day when she and Vincent knew someone in their house was doomed. She looked up and spied the moon and instantly knew what this night had brought. She now thought one word. Her sister's name. Jet.
"What is it?"
Hay said, concerned. When Vincent reached them, he was pale with shock. "They had an accident." He looked so young, standing there, barefoot, his bravado gone. Because Franny appeared to be frozen, he grabbed her hand. "I know what you're thinking, but she's alive." Which meant the others were not. Franny and Vincent took off across the park together. Halen called out, but Franny couldn't answer. She was running too hard. She didn't realize that she was also barefoot until they'd reached the pavement. She stood shivering on Fifth Avenue while Vincent hailed a cab. They sat side by side in the ER at Bellevue, not speaking. The cold linoleum floor nearly froze their feet. When the doctor came to speak to them, it was long past midnight. "Your sister has a concussion and several broken ribs," the doctor told them. "She's shaken up, and we had to stitch up her face, but she'll be fine."
"And our parents?" Franny asked.
The doctor shook his head. "I'm sorry. It was instantaneous. And the boy also just passed on." Franny and Vincent exchanged a look.
They had completely forgotten that Jet had intended to meet Levi.
"You mean he's dead?" Vincent asked.
"He was struck by the cab your parents were in." Franny had never felt so cold.
"They followed her. They chased after them."
Vincent draped his jacket over her shoulders. "Let's go see Jet." She was in a small private room, her black hair streaming onto the white pillow. Her face and arms were bruised and bandaged, and there was a gash on her face that had been closed with 30 neat stitches. Her eyes were rimmed red. It was her birthday, her night, her parents, her beloved. Guilt was curling around her heart with tendrils of self-hatred. In one instant, she had lost everything. Franny came to sit on the edge of the bed.
"There was nothing any of us could do to stop it. You can't blame yourself, Jetty. It was an accident."
Jet leaned into the soft pillow. She was doomed to lose everything, even her gift of sight. When they'd first brought her into the hospital, she could hear the patient's jumbled thoughts. Hearts that beat stopped with a shudder. Men who were racked with pain. Then all at once she couldn't hear a thing. The only sound that reverberated was the voice of the Reverend, who'd come to a room down the hall and set to wailing when he found his son, here in New York City, a place he had always believed caused ruination. He had been right about the curse, for this was what love had done to his boy, who never would have been struck if not for Jet. Although she'd never met the Reverend and he likely despised her, there was no one Jet felt she had more in common with than he. For the person they both loved best in the world was gone. The furniture was draped with white sheets, as Aunt Isabel instructed they must do when they entered the mourning period. She had arrived late that night without a suitcase, though she carried a large black purse. She had a black silk band around her right arm, and she wore a felted hat with one ember feather attached to the brim. She told them they needed to turn the mirrors to the wall. Then she had them sprinkle salt on the windowsills and leave sprigs of rosemary outside the doors. "It was bad luck," she told them. "Nothing more." She sat beside Jet, offering a cup of tea, which Jet refused to drink.
"It was bound to happen," Jet said in a small, broken voice. "It was my fate."
"It wasn't fate. It was the interruption of fate. No one can control such things." Jet was thin and pale. She turned away from her aunt, tied up with guilt and grief. Isabel knew right away that her niece had lost the sight, for her eyes were a dull dove gray without light or life. Isabel slept in the room where the previous family's cook had cried herself to sleep every night. Franny had made up the bed with clean white sheets and had left lavender in the dresser drawers. Isabel unpacked her purse, in which she had a nightgown and slippers and a bar of black soap. "She never thought to choose courage," Isabel said.
"But she did choose courage, didn't she?"
"In life, we don't always get what we choose. I gave her what she needed." On the day of the funeral, Franny found two black dresses in their mother's closet. She was surprised to see several pairs of red shoes in the back of the closet, something her mother had forbidden them from wearing. Franny helped Jet to dress, pulling her nightgown over her head, then slipping the prettier of the dresses on her, treating her as if she were a child. Jet still hadn't slept or had a bite to eat. She thought of her parents, how she had often heard them talking late at night. If it wasn't true love that they'd had, then it was a true partnership. She couldn't imagine one without the other. Now she realized that she hadn't spent enough time with them, or told them she loved them. Perhaps she hadn't even known. All she knew was that she didn't feel safe with them gone. Anything could happen now. Whatever their world had been, it would never be again. She sat in a chair in the living room, wearing her black dress, hands folded in her lap as she watched the door,
as if she expected their parents to walk through. Maybe then time would have rolled backward. Maybe then Levi would still be alive. Vincent, bleary-eyed and ravaged, had on a black suit he hadn't bothered to press. When he came out of his room barefoot, Isabel insisted he go back for his boots. That was the way in which their family members were buried, and it was disconcerting to see Vincent without shoes. At the funeral home on Madison Avenue, the coffins were closed. The mortician had been instructed that both their mother and father must wear black and be barefoot. Franny had chosen a Chanel dress for their mother and handed over her favorite red lipstick and Maybelline mascara, for she never went without her makeup, and Franny was not about to have that change. For their father, Vincent had taken a Brooks Brothers suit from the closet, along with one of the white shirts he had had tailored in London. Franny had straightened her own unruly hair with an iron and dabbed on pale lipstick so that she might look presentable. There was no way to hide the wound on Jet's face, though Franny tried with some powder from one of their mother's gold compacts. It looked as though blue flowers had been stamped on Jet's skin. Even when it healed, a jagged line would run down one side of her face. Not that Jet cared. Nothing would be punishment enough for having lived through the accident. She kept seeing Levi put his arm out and step in front of her, and then she saw stars, and he called her name, or maybe it was only a sigh, the last of his life and breath rising up. "You know he was related to us," Vincent told Franny.
"No," she looked at her brother. "How so?"
He shrugged. "Isabel wouldn't tell me."
"Jet has lost the gift," Franny said sadly. "I didn't know that could happen."
Their sister was still sitting in the chair, though the car had come for them. She barely seemed to breathe.
"She'll get it back," Vincent said. "It's in her blood."
At the chapel in Manhattan, vases of orange and red gladiolus were set onto the polished tables. Aunt Isabel sat with them in the front row. No one in the family cried. Although they were crushed, crying in public was unacceptable. Several of Dr. Burke Owens's patients who were in attendance were inconsolable. After the service, Franny and Vincent shook the hands of those who had come to pay their respects, while Isabel sat in the parlor with Jet. Hay was there, along with his parents, who were polite and distant and quick to suggest that Halen hurry along. But he wasn't about to desert Franny, even though a limo was waiting to take the Owens siblings to the cemetery in Massachusetts for the interment.
"She has to leave," Mr. Walker muttered. "Their car is here."
"Fuck the car."
"I want to go with you," Hay told Franny.
"I should be there." Aunt Isabel had come up behind them.
"I like him.
He should come with us."
"Impossible,"
Franny said. She wanted to keep Halen away from her family's troubles. It was bad enough that she must now introduce her aunt to the Walkers.
"You're quite rich," Isabel said to Mr. Walker, "and yet you seem to have so little."
Halen grinned when he overheard her remark.
"You're quite rude," Mr. Walker said.
"My niece and her husband are about to be buried. Who's the rude one?"
"I think we know the answer to that one, Dad," Halen said.
Franny took her aunt by the hand to lead her away.
"Not here," she urged. "Not now."
"What do you think I would do to that horrid man?" Isabel said. "Believe me, he'll bring on his own bad luck. His son, well, he's another story. He's the real thing."
She waved at Halen, and he waved back.
Unlike most people, he was completely undaunted by Isabel Owens.
Franny went to explain that there would be only family in Massachusetts, and all of the Owenses gathered in one place was far too much for any outsider to deal with.
"I don't mind," Halen said, "especially if they're all like your aunt."
"I'll phone as soon as I'm back," Franny promised.
The burial was to be held in the small graveyard in Massachusetts, the one they'd once peered at through the mossy iron fence, not especially interested, not even when they realized the old headstones were all engraved with the name Owens.
Now their parents would be there, even though their mother had spent her entire life trying her best to get away from her family. And yet this place had continued to